All right. Well, thank you very much to the organizers for having me. Well, first of all, for having invited me to come, and second of all, for having given me a second chance to talk about these things. A first version of this talk, which was really about some secondary results out of this investigation, was given a couple of weeks ago at Physics, and it was really about QPOs. But today, given this is about gravity, I'm going to talk about some work we've done on the dynamics of these objects, toroidal neutron stars. And so here is a little plan of my talk. First of all, I'll try to give a definition of what on Earth toroidal neutron stars are. I'll tell you a bit about the runaway instability, which is a natural way in which these objects can be studied. I'll tell you how, by studying the runaway instability, we ended up into looking at quasi-periodic accretion and gravitational wave emission. I don't think I'll have much time to say about the number of physical fallbacks that this investigation has brought to understand how this instability develops, to understand some very puzzling observations which are made in low-mass X-ray binaries, and I'll say something about what is in our future. The people involved in this investigation are Shin Yoshida and Arindo Zanotti, a postdoc and a graduate student in CISA, and Tony Font in Valencia. So before I actually go into the science of this, I'll be a bit provocative, and I'll ask you a following question, which has multiple choices. So how confident are you that all the relevant sources of gravitational waves have been considered? And there are three options, and you can think of them. And if you want, you can interpret my talk as the way in which I've gone from putting a tick into very confident to putting a tick into confident, okay? This will become clear at the end of my talk, but bear this in mind. So, basic equations. Consider a stationary and axisymmetric space-time. Most of the simulations I'll show here are done in a Schwarzschild space-time, but we are doing now also in Kern. We don't find anything new besides what I'm going to tell you today. Well, consider a perfect fluid which is not self-gravitating in this space-time, and this is its stress energy tensor. Decide it obeys a barotropic equation of state, so polytropic equation of state with gamma equal 4/3. And then, in order to describe the motion of this guy, use this quantity, the specific angular momentum, and this basically goes to omega r squared in the Newtonian limit. Now, once you do this, and you impose and you look for equilibrium, so static and axisymmetric configurations, you end up with the Euler equation, which basically become Bernoulli-type equations. It's very simple. And you can see that these are, you know, almost like in 101 astrophysics, you have pressure gradients, balances, gravitational forces. This is the energy per unit mass, plus corrections coming from centrifugal forces. Okay, so very simple to interpret. Now, the simplest solution to this equation is, well, L is equal to a constant, because this term just drops, and you got something which you can actually integrate. And if you use a polytropic equation of state, the integration is actually analytical. So that's beautiful. You can write your P, or if you want your rho, and then you have the possibility of writing the isobaric surfaces for these objects in terms of your equation of state and of the properties, the motion you have chosen for this guy. So basically, this is the density distribution in R and theta for this object in equilibrium. So I sometimes use W, which is just the log of UT, as my variable. Now, if L is equal constant, the isobaric surfaces are also equipotential surfaces, and this helps a lot in understanding the dynamics. And these depend just by two variables. In a Schwarzschild space-time, these are M and L, so the mass and the value you've chosen for your specific angular momentum. Just so that everything is perfectly clear, suppose you are in a Schwarzschild space-time, so this line is the specific angular momentum for a Keplerian motion, has this behavior like this and diverges at 2m, then you choose a value for your specific angular momentum to be a constant, so a straight line. Once you do this, you intersect this curve in two points, which single out two important points in the effective potential. One is the cusp, and one is the center. So basically, your equipotential surfaces look something like this. An important thing is that there is a cusp, so there is a one of the equipotential surfaces does not close on the black hole, okay? And then there is the center, which is basically the point of maximum density. So you really have to think of these as isobaric surfaces, bags in which you can contain your fluid, which is rotating in an around this axis on the plane of the blackboard. Now, so...
So the hole is infinitely heavy, and this is basically a reaction to the
metric. The fluid is not changing the metric. It's just a black hole space-time. In principle, you would need to take into account also the gravity of the fluid, but that's not what we're doing here. Now...
Could you do this in a Newtonian model with a central orbit?
Sure, you can, yeah. Yeah. Although, in that case, you don't have the cusp anymore. The cusp is really a relativistic effect. Now, here is a definition. So, a toroidal neutron star is defined as a nucleon-rich fluid configuration which fills exactly this surface, which has a mass of the order of less than a solar mass, and so which has a cusp. Okay? Now, we come up with this definition basically going back to some previous definition of toroidal stars. So in the past, in the 70s, people when they were first studying these objects, they called them toroidal stars, and we added just neutrons because of the genesis of these objects. So it was mostly a joke, but then somehow this joke picked up, and now people I've seen this term used in several places. This is not a big deal. What I think is important is to distinguish these objects from an accretion disk. It is different for two reasons. First of all, it's more massive and compact. These are really small objects. And second of all, it's not accreting at all, at least in principle. So this is really, in a sense, like a star. It emits stationary solutions which are governed by pressure gradients, gravitational forces, and centrifugal forces.
What scenario are you thinking of to get these?
So there are a number of ways in which you can get these objects. One is if you have a binary merger of two neutron stars with unequal masses, then simulations indicate that you might end up with a black hole being produced, which is surrounded by a torus of matter, which is still nucleon-rich, low entropy, and so this could be, for instance, one way in which you can create it. You can also think if you have a collapse, either of a stellar core or a rotating supermassive neutron star, that if you have enough angular momentum in the outer regions, and you could have that, for instance, if you have differential rotation, then part of the mass will go into the black hole, and part of the mass will go out in the torus. Now, something important to underline, and I'm picking up on your question, is that these objects are not stable. I mean, they shouldn't be considered, although they emit solutions which are stationary, the lifetime of these objects astrophysically is very short, you know, of the order of a few seconds. Okay, and in fact, this is why astrophysicists are interested in these guys.
So the rings of Saturn are stable for another reason?
Well, those are really, pressure gradients really are not important there, okay? The different, in fact, they are almost thin, geometrically thin. Yeah.
So is the gravity of this torus always important, or can it ever be
affected? It should be taken into account in full GR. We're not doing that, and we're assuming just that the mass is sufficiently small as compared to the black hole mass that can be treated in as an approximation, you know, and not a relevant change.
So
but it is important, yes.
With this approximation, then why is that mechanism you said viable? Because the mechanism of these two neutron stars, you know.
So that's the genesis. That's the genesis. Okay. So I'm telling you how you could end up with this object. Okay. Now once you have this object, I will discuss about what is its dynamics, in the limit in which its mass.
In that case, the mass of the black hole is going to be compatible with the.
Oh no. In fact, you are thinking about something like 10% of the mass of the torus, the mass of the torus being just 10% of the mass of the black hole in a binary merger scenario. So anyway, you're talking about a small contribution to the overall space-time. Okay? So you shouldn't think that if you have two neutron stars with unequal masses, you end up with half of the matter out and half of the matter in the black hole. Yeah.
10% is small in this.
Yeah.
What stabilizes the vertical?
Pressure gradients.
But there's no gravity.
Well, this thing is orbiting very rapidly, okay, and has pressure gradients.
So can you really get toruses with nuclear densities?
So that's a good question. I mean, you really would need to simulate this, right? And the simulations which have been done are in Newtonian framework by Ruffert et al. And they indicate that you have very neutron-rich material, low-entropy material in these tori. So of density 10 to the 13 grams per cubic centimeter maximum.
Seems hard to believe, actually.
Well, okay, but...
neglecting solid gravity, what does it matter?
Well, it's not clear. It's not clear what it matters. But in fact, it's not very important of what I'm going to discuss hereafter. So I don't know whether you have to believe those numbers or not. I mean, I'm just quoting that those are the most accurate calculations so far. So the reason why these objects are interesting is because of a dynamical instability, which is called the runaway instability. So consider a marginally stable toroidal neutron star, which I call sometimes disk here, which is filling its Roche loop. So it's filling exactly this surface with a cusp. Then, because it's in equilibrium, all the inertial forces give zero acceleration. But at the cusp, just as like at the center, the pressure plays no role. There you really have geodetic motion. And in fact, that's how you got that point, by intersecting your specific angular momentum with a Keplerian one. So imagine yourself, you're a fluid element sitting on that cusp. You are in a marginally stable equilibrium. Any perturbation will make you fall onto the black hole. This will change the mass of the black hole and thus the position of the cusp in a nonlinear way. And so there are two possible ways in which this can happen. So you are this fluid element sitting on this point. Something perturbs you and you fall onto the black hole. The black hole will change its mass. This will change the isobaric surfaces. So the first possibility is that as a consequence of all this, the cusp moves towards the black hole, and then you have that the new configuration is stable. The other possibility is that the cusp moves away from the black hole into the fluid. Well, if that happens, a fluid element which was sitting on a perfectly stable orbit finds itself now in a marginally stable orbit. And so again, it might fall onto the black hole, and this will produce a runaway mechanism, and therefore could create an instability. Now, this is very appealing for people working gamma ray bursts, because this could provide a very good way of having a torus of matter, which is involved by these models, to fall very rapidly onto the black hole. Okay. So, to answer Carson's question, what is the role played by self-gravity? Well, it's there have been a lot of debates on whether this is important or not. If the mass of the torus is very small, clearly that's not an important effect. If it is, you know, comparable with the mass of the black hole, that could be an important effect. But this is not something we're going to address now. We're going to address what happens in the case in which the mass of the torus is small, and so you can neglect self-gravity. So the way we do this, we have a 2D numerical code that solves the generativistic Hadow equations on a given curved spacetime, for instance, Schwarzschild curve or what you want. It has high-resolution shock capturing techniques, and these yield very high accuracy, good resolution of discontinuities, and small dissipation. And this is actually essential for what we have unveiled, the fact that we were able to describe very accurately the dynamics of this object. Now, in numerical relativity terms, this setup is not particularly complicated, or it's not the most challenging, if you wish. But you know, the physics behind the dynamics makes up for all the simplicity in the numerics. The space-time evolution. In principle, what you would like to do is solve Einstein's equation, okay? But maybe there are ways around this. And it's clear that are the changes in the space-time that are at the heart of the problem, because it's the way in which these isobaric surfaces change that determines the dynamics of the fluid. So the way we do it is, the way we do this dynamical space-time evolution is that we change instantaneously the metric functions at a given time from one time level Tn to the following one in terms of the amount of rest mass which is accreted onto the black hole. So we calculate what is the mass which goes into the black hole, and we update instantaneously the metric. So in this way, the evolution is really replaced by a sequence of stationary spacetimes which differ by just delta m. This is a very good approximation if you have small accretion rates. In other words, if your delta m over delta t is very small. However, you have to pay something for this. That is that you have no gravitational waves. You can't detect, although you can, not directly from the Einstein's equations at least, and that you cannot account for things like the angular momentum transfer to the black hole, which is, again, a rather interesting physics problem. Another way in which we can do the space-time evolution is just to keep the space-time fixed, okay? And this is not a... this will have its importance, too. That's right. That's what we do now with Kerr. So, no big deal about it. The problem there is that how do you measure the amount of angular momentum transfer? It's a bit of a tricky point, and you can parameterize that, but it's not a clean answer. Yep.
So if you apply the left side of the black hole,
Well, in principle, yes. The changes are so small that are below the resolution of our code, so we don't really bother about it.
Okay. What's the problem with finding the angular momentum transfer to occur? Can't we just take the flux of stress energy dotted into angular Killing field crossing the horizon?
Yeah, the point is that doesn't give you a physical answer. That gives you just a numerical answer. In other words, if you want to know what is the transfer of angular momentum, you would need to take into account how much of that angular momentum really goes onto the black hole and doesn't go, for instance, to other fluid elements. In other words, in physics, in astrophysics, these objects would have also a shear, and so you would have a loss of angular momentum, not just towards the black hole, but also moving outside. So
you neglect pressure, why can't you neglect shear?
We're not neglecting pressure.
No, but for the stuff that's falling, you said it's sort of marginally geodesic, so you're neglecting pressure there.
That's just for a particle, okay? So we're not neglecting pressure. We're solving for the full fluid equations. The answer to your point is that you can do this. I don't find this, an astrophysically useful quantity because, it's just telling me how much... I can calculate that flux, yes, no problem. But it doesn't tell me anything on how... Suppose I start with a black hole, which is a Schwarzschild. How rapidly, as a consequence of accretion, I can bring it up to a Kerr black hole. It's, it's something that... really has no physical meaning.
Well, I don't understand that. Just to me, as if you say you can, now that does mean you're neglecting viscosity in your fluid, which you are anyway, right? And I would guess that if you took into account viscosity explicitly in your equations, that would modify what's going on in your viscosity quite implicitly.
It could, yes. In fact, what would happen is that if I had viscosity, then I wouldn't. The system would never be static, would never be in equilibrium, would always be accreting. Now, the amount of accretion would be determined by the amount of, angular momentum loss through that point. So, it's something that one would need to do. The problem with that is that I would need to solve for an inviscid hydro equation, and that's much more complicated to do in GR. So the picture I'm telling you is for an inviscid fluid. In the case of an inviscid fluid, I could take into account for the transfer of angular momentum to the black hole. It's something that I don't find, particularly interesting.
But viscous corrections to the flux are small. The viscous contribution to the stress tensor are much smaller than the pieces you're keeping. So I would think it would be a good approximation all the time.
You mean, sorry, I don't understand your question.
Stress energy dotted into the fine Killing field gives you flux of angular momentum.
That's right.
So if you put viscosity in, the viscous contributions to this, so you could add the viscous parts of the stress tensor and do the same thing. And so what is the difference between those? And the difference is the extra viscous pieces you add to the stress tensor, but they're very small compared to the dominant. Perfect.
Well, it depends on what scenario you're looking at. It is true. Well, it depends. If you're thinking about something which is, you know, quasi-stationary accreting, that's true. But as I'll show you, this is not something we are considering here. Okay, and you will see that the mass accretion rates you can get in this mechanism are far super Eddington. So it might even be better than what you're saying.
But if you do a quasi-stationary approximation to your calculation, then you might as well make it complete. So I think he is right. And I don't see why you wouldn't want to include the mass transfer, not the elemental transfer, if they're consistent within the same approximation you make.
Okay, as I said, this is something we are working on. The results I'll be presenting here today are about a Schwarzschild black hole. The Schwarzschild black hole, we don't take into account the angular momentum transfer, and if you take my word for correct, the dynamics I'm going to tell you today is exactly the same with the dynamics of the Kerr black hole. The only difference is that in the case of a Kerr black hole, I can measure what is the amount of angular momentum transfer onto the black hole, and this will give me the amount in which the black hole is, you know, the Kerr parameter goes up as a function of time. I don't find this something worth discussing here. Okay.
So, did you say that the mass of the charge was roughly up to about 10% of the mass of the black hole?
Yeah.
So you can figure out how much angular momentum it had, whether it would significantly change the black hole.
Yeah, but again, it's you are assuming that all of that angular momentum goes into the black hole, and that's not what is happens in astrophysics. Yeah. That's a maximum. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, going back to the initial data. So I've shown you that the initial data is very simple. Okay. But if you want to simulate the instability, you have the problem that even a toroidal neutron star is marginally stable at best. It means that the growth time for the instability is infinite. Now, what you usually say in this case is that, well, just put that thing on a numerical grid, and the truncation error will do the job of triggering the instability. That's true most of the time. It's not been true in our case. We put something which is marginally stable on the numerical grid, and the thing remained there, possibly because, you know, the code is very accurate. So you need to produce some deviation way out of equilibrium. Now, a brute force way of doing this is that you fill an equipotential surface which is external to the one with the cusp. So basically, you already have fluid outside its Roche lobe. And that's a possibility. The other possibility is that you perturb the marginally stable configuration. In other words, you take your torus, which is filling its Roche lobe, and you add a radial inward velocity. And you do this in terms of a known solution, okay, which is a spherical accretion onto a Schwarzschild black hole, and you parameterize this in terms of a small parameter eta, which you can change at your wish, and this goes between 0.1% to 20%. Okay, so this is what happens when you do all of this. I'm showing you a mass ratio here which is 1, just because the numbers, I mean, the code can handle better the changes in the mass accretion rate in this case, but I can show exactly similar curves also. I'll show it in a second, in fact. So just to have an idea of what happens, this is the mass accretion rate, so the amount of mass which goes onto the black hole as a function of time. And you see that there are three curves. One for a 6% perturbation, one for a 4% perturbation, and one for a 2% perturbation. So you see that in both cases, the runaway instability takes place. This is shown by the fact that the mass accretion rate diverges exponentially. And another thing which you observe is that if you have small perturbations, initial perturbations, the runaway instability takes a longer time to develop. Okay, so you have a period where basically there is no accretion, then you start having some pulsed accretion, and then eventually the instability takes off. What is important to concentrate on here is that there isn't a single growth in the mass accretion rate, but there are these pulses which accompany it. Yeah. What happens if you change the mass accretion rate? Sorry, the so in other words, the initial mass ratio. Well, qualitatively, the things can be very different because you have different accretion rates, different growth times, and so on and so forth. Just to remind you, in the case of a mass ratio equal 1, everything would happen in about, so for 6% perturbation, everything would happen in about 10 dynamical timescales. Okay? If you have smaller masses, then it's going to take longer, and so more computer time. But at the end, the overall result is the same. Also, if you have smaller mass ratio, you end up with having smaller accretion rates. You see here the floor is much smaller. And so basically, there are quantitative differences, but qualitative, there are no differences. Okay? It's just that the time scale for instability is set up by the efficiency in which you accrete matter onto the black hole.
So, what's the upper envelope for that thing? Is that actually exponentially increasing?
You mean this curve here? Sorry.
Well, it was sort of, I mean, it's accreting in little lumps, but then.
Yes. Okay. Well, yeah. And it is basically an exponential envelope. Yeah.
There's other sources of viscosity. Well, you expect there's viscosity in the disk. I mean, so when there's the magnetic rotational instability, which everyone thinks is causing accretion. So, did you try and compare the e-folding time for this?
No, I haven't tried that. No, I haven't tried that because.
In the MRI, it's just one rotation period, you get an e-fold.
Yeah.
So, but this looks like it's comparable. Actually.
Yeah. So, what I'm going to show next is actually an animation of how this happens. What I'm going to show, so this is the rest mass density profile of the torus, okay, and the color coding just gives you the different values. All right. Okay, so you see that these funnels of matter are those that are producing the pulses in the mass accretion rates, and okay, I guess I'll have to show it again. So you have the perturbation, the system reacts to the perturbation, first in an harmonic way, then you have matter going onto the black hole. The black hole mass is growing in time, although you don't see there, and then basically the instability takes place. I've shown this, which is the most, you know, the most dramatic case, very large mass ratios, very large initial perturbation. Okay, so basically, this is the way the instability works. But it's not really the instability I'm interested in, and I want to talk to you about. So, as Phil was mentioning, there is an exponential envelope, but then there are also periodic oscillations. Okay, so I would say that I can see clearly that the exponential envelope, I can see the instability growing very evidently from this point onwards, and basically the mass accretion rate never goes back to zero. So basically there is always a flux of matter going onto the black hole. And so this period is a period of oscillations. Okay? These models have at the same initial perturbation, just different mass ratio. Okay? So what one would like to do is to single out periodic oscillation from the instability. The instability is a consequence of changing the space-time large mass ratios. This could be something which will happen instead if you have small mass ratios. And it's very simple to do this, to single out these two phenomena, simply by suppressing the space-time evolution, because the space-time evolution is the feedback which provokes the instability. So this is the same simulation, basically. The same simulation. But with now the space-time being held fixed. And as you can see, there is an initial perturbation. There are these small funnels of matter that go into the black hole. But besides that, everything is almost behaving harmonically. Okay? So this is a very simple way of distinguishing the oscillations of these objects from the actual runaway instability. And from here onwards, I will really concentrate just on these oscillations here.
Well, since the space-time dynamics is so important for this phenomenon.
That's right.
It's not clear to me that the approximation scheme is consistent in the sense that one is first saying that 10% mass outside the black hole is negligible.
Okay, that's negligible for not taking into account as far as the space-time.
Yes, as far as space-time.
Okay, yeah.
I'm talking about space-time dynamics, precisely, as far as space-time is concerned.
Okay.
But then, you know, very small fraction of that mass is actually falling in.
That's right.
And now, however, that is somehow made dynamical. Supposing I could solve the whole problem in full general intuition.
Sure.
I would see that there are these two components. One is that the black hole is growing. There's also speed of light, but let's not worry about that. But this black hole is growing. And there's also this mass outside is contributing to the geometry, the dynamics. Now we're somehow suppressing one component, mass outside contributing to geometry.
That's right.
Taking into account only the growth of the black hole.
That's right.
As contributing to geometry. And it's not clear to me that one can be negligible to the other.
You can surely imagine a situation where this is possible, okay? If you have a tenuous fluid, so not very massive, then you can play this exact same game. So you don't have a lot of mass. You can still have a fluid with these dimensions, which will accrete onto the black hole. Its contribution to the space-time geometry will be negligible, but yet it will oscillate just in this shape. In fact, you can show that this happens also in a Newtonian potential.
That's
okay. Okay.
That's
so
the part that dynamics of space-time geometry is critical, but one is only taking into account one component of the dynamics, which is really how the black hole is growing. And what is not taking into account at all change in dynamics because of the effect of the fluid on the dynamics of the...
So if I understand your question, you think that this is not a conclusive answer on whether the instability takes place or not, and one would really need to take into account the contribution
right.
to the space-time beyond. That's perfectly correct, yes. So this is not the final answer. I'm just saying, in this setup, which could be valid in certain circumstances, this could take place. The final answer will not even come when we take into account space-time correction due to the fluid, because at that point, one will need to take into account magnetic fields, non-axis symmetric deviation, and all of the rest. So this is, you know, work in progress in this respect.
I guess what you're doing is when the mass belongs to the fluid, that mass is not producing a gravitational field on the fluid.
That's right.
When you transfer it to the hole, now you count it as
that's right.
a gravitational field on the
hole.
Correct. So there is a little bit of worry about how big a mass you can transfer.
That's right. So certainly there is a range in your parameter space where you shouldn't trust these results, but there is one which you should, and this is what I'm trying to convince you that you should concentrate on that part of the parameter space. Yep.
I am worried that your neglected momentum being accreted is not consistent. I mean, there is a first order effect, reaction to the metric due to the angular momentum, and that will have an effect on the orbits of dynamics of stuff near the cusp. And I'm worried that you might be missing something.
Okay, your worry is perfectly legitimate. I can make you feel more comfortable saying when you do this in Kerr, and I can show you a plot, nothing changes. Even when you take into account of the angular momentum distribution, or the angular momentum accretion, and so the change also in the non-diagonal terms of the metric. Okay, so it's a concern in principle. I can show you this is not something one should worry about. Sorry.
You separate the two sort of time scales, right?
That's right.
The period of oscillation and period of instability. So what is the mass of the black hole at the beginning of the onset of the instability? So in a sense, how much mass of the fluid has accreted onto the black hole at the onset of this instability?
Yeah, it's very small, less than a few percent. Okay, that's when the instability really develops clearly.
Initially, there's only 10% mass in the disk outside.
That's right.
Outside. And so
I'm telling you that the few percent is a few percent of the mass. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So what happens when you fix the space time? Well, this brings out a quasi-periodic response, and you can see clearly here. These different curves, just like in the case before, are representative of three different initial perturbations. So the bigger the oscillation, the bigger is the initial perturbation you give. So this is very simple to interpret. And you can see that it's a almost periodic behavior in time. We've run this for 100 timescale, and basically we could run for much longer. So basically, you know, this is much of what we would expect, although, you know, it's nice to see that the code can be so accurate for so long. Now, the mass accretion rate is not the only quantity which varies periodically, and actually is not the most important one, because it's not really telling you about the fluid behavior. It's just telling you about what the matter which goes on to the black hole. So all the other variables exhibit this harmonic behavior. Now, suppose that you were looking at those movies, you are concentrating on the red dot, you know, the point of maximum density, and you plot the time series of that guy, you see that this is what happens. So you see something here at the beginning which is not quite harmonic because the system is recovering from your perturbation, and then basically continues on almost harmonic way. Again, different curves are showing different initial perturbations, and you see that for a very long time the thing is almost a constant amplitude. There is this small secular decay, and this is produced by the fact that, you know, the code is very accurate but still has a small dissipation. Now, the first thing you worry about it when you start looking at these things is how generic are these results? So how much does depend on the specific model chosen? So once again, the answer is quantitatively there can be large differences. And for instance, we can look at the fundamental frequency of oscillation in that quantity and plot it versus the central density. And you see that, you know, the frequency can change, but for a sequence of constant fresh mass, the changes are following a precise rule. So basically, they can be studied in a systematic way. So qualitatively, there are no differences. These objects have different masses, different densities. Sorry, different densities, not the same mass. Different angular momentum, different sizes, but they all show the same behavior, just different frequencies. Okay. So basically, these are really the fundamental axisymmetric oscillations of 2D massive disk in GR. And if you want, this is disco seismology simulated on a computer. Now, a question is, I say quasi-periodic, so how periodic is periodic? What you can do is you can take your mass accretion rate, Fourier transform it, and you get a power spectrum which looks like this. Now, these are very nice peaks because we have a long time series, but it's clear that, you know, that there is an harmonicity here. This is the first mode, the second overtone, the third overtone. And so basically there is a sequence 1, 2, 3. But it's not really a good quantity to take. If you look at, for instance, at the variation in the rest mass density, you see that there are also other peaks, so at intermediate frequencies. And so that the real sequence is 2, 3, 4. Okay? Now, I don't have time to discuss about the consequences of this, but this has very important consequences, we think, for the observational QPOs in low mass X-ray bands which have a black hole candidate. This is basically something I was telling some of you the other day. I'll be happy to go on this, maybe in private. Now, are these objects relevant as far as gravitational wave emission is concerned? So these guys are axisymmetric, but they have time-varying mass quadrupoles, and therefore can emit gravitational waves already in this scenario. So we use a quadrupole approximation, internal quadrupole approximation, we can calculate the gravitational wave strain in terms of the second time derivative of the mass quadrupole. So basically, we just take the mass quadrupole and we calculate the time derivative. We don't really calculate the time derivative because there are tricks to avoid this. You can write this using Euler equation and write this in terms of integrals over the fluid variables or the potential. Okay. Now, when we do this, we're clearly making an error because it's a Newtonian approximation. So, because we're in axisymmetry, these gravitational waves do not carry angular momentum, but just carry energy. Okay, we still have a phi-killing vector. And again, if we were to solve Einstein's equation, we would see that the black hole would radiate on top of this, but we cannot follow this clearly. Although we are working on how to do this perturbatively. Now, so the question was, are these relevant? We calculate this mass quadrupole variation. This is as a function of time. This is for a small period, and you see basically that these are very large numbers. Now, written like that doesn't give you a flavor, but when you compare with known sources, you find out that it is comparable, or larger if you use large mass ratios, to what you would expect from stellar core collapse and supernova explosions. Now, when we first realized this, we were quite certain there was an error somewhere, and so we double-checked and triple-checked, and nothing. We always got the same answer. And then it became apparent why, after all, this is quite obvious. The gravitational wave strain times R is basically just a time derivative of the mass quadrupole. So you're taking a time derivative of this guy here. So you have an integral of rho r to the fourth. Now, for a star, rho is a function which has a maximum r equals 0 and then falls off in some shape. For a torus, rho is 0 at 0, and s has a maximum somewhere outside. So intrinsically, the mass quadrupole is large. Even though you have small masses, as long as you have large rows, and for instance, by producing this in this scenario, then you are guaranteed to have large mass quadrupoles, and therefore small variations of these mass quadrupoles can give gravitational waves, which are comparable with what you would expect from a supernova explosion. I'm referring to what is computed from simulations, okay? So the simulations so far carried out are in axis symmetry, the best one by Mueller and Dimmelmeier and collaborators.
The initial data are...
No, I don't think so. I think they are pretty well, they have a pretty well understanding what is the initial data. Yeah, I mean, there are some subtleties about how the collapse takes place. I don't think that that's their weak point.
What's the radius of the peak? What's the location of the peak density from the center of the?
You're talking if a few tens of gravitational radii. So these are very compact objects.
Like 20
m. Yeah. Now, there's a title here which has been cut out, and it's scaling properties. Now, if you want to make sense of these results, you want to give an estimate which allows you to say, given a certain mass and given a certain distance and given a certain perturbation, I can tell you what is the gravitational wave strain. So the way to do this is you study your results carefully. So for instance, you study how does the maximum density changes as a response of the perturbation. And I think this is a very nice plot telling you a lot of physics. So clearly there is this area here where the response is linear, and you can see there is a blow up, and you can see it's extremely linear. So here you have a linear regime. Then as you crank up the amplitude, the rest mass density, the maximum rest mass density doesn't increase anymore, but actually has a fall off. The reason for this is that we are concentrating here on the first fundamental mode, and then by the time you reach here, you are in a fully nonlinear regime, and so you start seeing mode cascading so that the energy in the fundamental is distributed to all the other overtones which are available, and as a result, the maximum goes down. This is very nice to see if you look at power spectra. So this tells you that if you are about 5% of perturbation, you are pretty confident that it's you can use a linear approximation. And this, again, tells you how the mass quadrupole changes as a function of the mass ratio. Okay, this is, again, something which, in a certain regime, well, in the relevant regime from 0 to 1 is almost linear. So putting the two things together, you end up with this formula, which tells you that you have a gravitational wave strain, which is 10 to the minus 21, for 4% perturbation, a 0.1 ratio in the masses, and you have a source at 10 kiloparsec. Again, this is, I think, the only thing you have to take out of this room. This is comparable or larger with what expected from stellar core collapse. And also the event rate, you know, could be comparable if this is coming, for instance, from collapse. Now, compare with the sensitivity of known interferometers, and you see that, well, in the unlikely but lucky circumstance that you have something which is very close, you will certainly see even with LIGO 1. In the most likely but unfortunate situation, which the thing is somewhere in the Virgo cluster, or quite in the outskirts of the Virgo cluster, you will not make it with LIGO 2, although this Euro proposed detector will do it. So the bottom line is, given these sensitivities, this could be new sources of gravitational waves. Now, you can go further in this, and somehow the thing is cut. So you can assume a constant amplitude oscillations, okay? So I'm not taking into account the instability, and get a signal-to-noise ratio. Well, you know, this is just the characteristic amplitude over the sensitivity of the instrument, and you calculate this in the usual way. So here I'm showing you different models, different mass ratios, different initial perturbations, and signal-to-noise ratios for different instruments. And you can see, well, if you are very close, then you get huge signal-to-noise ratio. If you are very far, then you get something below one. But still, you know, Euro might even be able to get something which is very far. Now, the important thing to stress is that when I calculate this guy, I need to calculate this Fourier transform, and this means I have to calculate a time integral. And the time integral I set to be the time, the lifetime of the object if it were unstable. Okay? So this is something I could well not do. So I think these estimates are conservative because of the following reason. If you have the instability taking place, okay, then this would favor detectability. So we have not included this exponential phase, and this, just like in binaries, provides a very important contribution. You know that, you know, if you take, for instance, 2% 2% perturbation, 10 kiloparsec, 1.1 ratio, the signal-to-noise ratio goes from 12 to 90, if I had to take that into account. So it's a huge gain. But, you know, we don't know. And I want to make a statement that the runaway instability takes place.
I think I missed this. What is the time scale of the exponential growth
compared to a period? Well, it depends on what is the mass ratio, okay? So remember, there were some small mass ratio, you can take 80 or so orbital periods. Large mass ratio, you can take just 10 orbital periods. Depends on the efficiency in which you are pouring matter onto the black hole.
Actually, is that, are you answering the question? Because I thought what I saw was that was while I was waiting for it to get up to the exponential growth that depended on the mass ratio. So I'm asking about the, you know, the final collapse, that exponential growth.
Oh, well, okay. That is really dynamical. I mean, it's...
So it's one... It's
yes.
Period.
Yeah, could be, yeah. Now, suppose, on the other hand, that the instability doesn't take place. Well, still, this would favor detectability, exactly for what I said, because you have a longer time scale for the oscillation, so you have a larger characteristic amplitude and hence a larger signal-to-noise ratio. Again, to give you an idea, if I instead of having 0.2 seconds, I go to 0.4 seconds, I get... Sorry, this is wrong. This is not 90. I've just copied that. This is, I think, 18. So, you know, not such a huge difference, but still. Now, because of the genesis, so either a binary merger or a collapse, this could be easier to detect, these oscillations, because there will be precursors either through gravitational waves or electromagnetic waves, and so this will not make them, you know, not a blind search, in other words. Another way in which all of this could be, you know, get better in gravitational wave terms is that if you... Now, these objects are axisymmetric, but they are well known to be unstable to non-axisymmetric perturbations under certain circumstances. If they are, then you could basically, these instabilities would damp these oscillations, but they would still increase the gravitational wave emission, okay? And this is something that Maurice van Putten has, for instance, considered in detail. Okay, so... I guess a relevant question is, what are these models then? Now, when we asked ourselves this question, we found out that there was no easy answer. And it's surprising how little is known about the oscillation properties of these objects. In Newtonian theory, there is just a couple of works, and rather different from the ones we are considering. And there is basically nothing for relativistic ones. So, you know, we basically had to go back to the blackboard and find for ourselves. This is in very stark contrast with what happens for stars. You know, stars, we know everything about their pulsation modes, even in the most complicated scenarios. Well, not everything, but a lot. So suppose that you are in a dark street and a guy with a gun is just asking you, well, give me an answer, what is this? So an educated guess would be, well, these are just epicyclic oscillations with frequency kr. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with this, well, I wasn't myself. Suppose that you are on a circular orbit around a black hole, okay? Then if you perturb this orbit, you will start oscillating around this orbit. And the frequency, the radial frequency, so as you've seen from the top, the radial frequency at which you oscillate, this is called the epicyclic oscillation, epicyclic frequency, kappa r. So what you could think is that basically this object is just oscillating at the epicyclic frequency. So we thought, well, that's exactly what we see, because we see this object moving in and out as if it was perturbed. Well, so that was a good answer, but effectively the answer is no. You can work this out in relativity, and that's what we had to do to find out it. Basically, in the case of constant angular momentum distribution, this is exactly zero. Okay, and basically this is because the fluid element doesn't know that it has been perturbed, because it maintains always the same angular momentum distribution. So that's something not an answer, but it's a good one. In fact, saves your life. And if you do things more carefully, and we've done this using a perturbative analysis, you see that these are what are called usually P modes, or inertial acoustic oscillation. So there are two parts in it. One is the acoustic response to the perturbation, and the other one is the inertial, which is produced by the fact that you are moving something out of an orbit, which is, and so basically there are two parts, and one of these is the epicyclic contribution. And you can see that when the torus size becomes very small, infinitesimally small, you end up actually converging to the epicyclic frequency. So basically, this is a pretty good answer. Now, again, there's a lot of interesting fallbacks which we found, which help us understand why the instability happens for some in some circumstances and in others it doesn't, and also has this connection with QPOs. But that's not something I will talk here. So I'm getting close to my conclusions. This is what I've shown, that in the present setup, when you can neglect the mass coming from the toroidal neutron star and you have a constant angular momentum distribution, these objects are runaway unstable. I will not make this a strong statement, though. When perturbed, toroidal neutron stars exhibit a regular response showing quasi-periodic mass accretion to the black hole, and this could have an observational consequence, because, you know, things falling onto the black hole get hot and emit radiation, but also quasi-periodic oscillation in the mass corpus, and this is what is more interesting for us. So these, as a result, because they have intrinsically large mass quadrupoles, these produce gravitational waves which are comparable with those coming from stellar collapse and may represent new sources. There's a lot of physics and astrophysics connected to these oscillations, which are now we are now unveiling, and some of this I have discussed in my previous talk. I'll be happy to answer any question on this. Now, I think there are two lessons I personally have learned from this. Unexpected social gravitational wave could exist and may be observed in the near future. And this is what has degraded my very confidence to confidence in that question I made you at the beginning of the talk. And the second lesson I learned is that disco seismology could be as something which has not been studied well enough and could provide important clues to some of the unanswered questions in astrophysics. Okay, thank you.
There's several things that make me think that this is interesting, but there's some obvious directions to go. First thing is non-axisymmetric perturbations taken in something like the context that you've done it. Be very interested in knowing what the growth rate is for, you know, e to the I m phi kinds of perturbations on this, which is likely to be quite high.
Well, okay. So that has been studied in the past in the following context, which is known as Papaloiseau and Pringle instability. And what these guys have studied is, if you take this object, for them was a thick disk, because there was a time in the 80s where people were thinking that a natural way of having jets is having very thick disks. which would collimate the, you know, the outflow of matter. And so there were a number of people who were very in favor of these thick disks. And then, you know, this is where all this literature started from. Then Papaleo and Pringle came in and destroyed the picture and said, take this object, it will be unstable to non-axis symmetric oscillation in the order of a few orbital time scale. Basically, you have these EM phi things which break the thing apart. M equal 1 is the fastest growing one. Now, so for some time, this looked to be very bad. Then Omar Blaise, who actually is a faculty here, found out that this is not true in general. Effectively, as soon as you have a little mass outflow from here, this instability is no longer there. And the reason this happens is that the Papaloison instability works if you have this acting as a reflecting point for waves traveling across the torus. If you have matter which goes onto the black hole, and so you basically are removing this you know, reflection point, then the instability is suppressed. And people have done simulations in 3D, now even in generativistic context, showing that, you know, this happens. If you have no accretion, the thing is unstable. If you have accretion, the thing is damped. So my attitude to non-axis symmetric instability is that they may be there, but they may not be there. Depends on how, you know, exactly on this. If you have sufficient accretion, then this instability will not show up. But it could be a very, you know, rewarding search anyway, because if you have something which is of the order of a few solar masses, which has a strong M equal 1 or M equal 2 structure and is orbiting rapidly around a black hole, that's surely going to give you some gravitational wave. I don't know if I... Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, well, one question is, you know, the constant momentum tori are sort of a special limiting case in that they are marginally unstable to axis symmetric perturbations. So you can certainly construct, you know, isobaric tori, which have an angular mass increasing outwards, and which are really stable to the axis symmetric perturbations. And unless you have some particular mechanism for why you think the formation process will lead to uniform angular momentum, maybe these would be more, you know, quite a bit more realistic models. And, you know, there's a well-defined procedure for constructing these models. And the question is, would they have the same kind of instability that you...
Okay. Well, let me say that I agree with all you said. I agree with the fact that constant angular momentum is really an idealization. Astrophysically, there is no reason why they should be like that. Actually, simulations show that you don't usually have that. The reason why people have stuck to this is because it's very simple. Equations become simpler. Yes, for analytic. Yes, yeah. So, okay. Okay, so because we wanted to address, you know, this all this literature which was developed on L equal constant, that's what we have done here. But now, let me see if I can bring up something which might answer your question. Okay, probably better off by looking it by hand. Okay, so. So Tony and Dane, using we are collaborating on this and we are looking at different things. So the way they triggered instability is by having no perturbation, okay, just having the thing out of equilibrium and then following what happens. So they have done basically the calculations I was mentioning about on a curved black hole, taking into account the angular momentum loss, okay? So this is an RPJ letter which has come out at the end of last year. Now, I should remind myself how these go. So basically, here you have all what we were talking about, okay? So if you here they have non-constant angular momentum tori, okay? What you find out in this case is that So if you have fixed M and fixed J, basically there is no instability, okay? It's the same. It's the same. So no, no, the initial black hole is Schwarzschild. Okay?
Varying J
means varying J. Sure. Yeah. J, big H. So, varying mass and keeping fixed J, you could have instability, and these are the cases where you can have it. And the discriminating between having or not having is exactly having a constant or non-constant angular momentum distribution. Okay? So, to address your question, it is true that the instability is sensitive to this parameter. And if you don't use a L equal constant, it's not clear whether you have it or not. And we also have a way of understanding this mechanism by looking at the eigenfunctions from our perturbative analysis. If you, on the other hand, vary both M and J, again, you have possible instabilities. The really discriminating point is what you said, having or not an L equal constant distribution. But this is, you know, I don't want that the important message delivered is that you have this instability. I personally am not particularly convinced that there is this instability. It might happen, but it's too early to say whether it's so or not.
Several people asked about the self-gravity. If I remember properly, if you make the same ansatz about L equals constant in a general stationary axisymmetric metric, you can do that same trick and solve for the fluid as
That's
a functional
right.
of the geometry and stick it back in. And so somebody could probably use a nice computer code to find those self-gravitating solutions with a fairly.
They have done that, in fact. They have done, and they found that it's as a okay. So it's hard to tell what is the effect because it's really a non-linear, you know, effect which has a time dependence in it. No. They haven't done it. So they've done is, you know, a solution of constraint, and they found that it seems that it has a stabilizing effect. So self-gravity seems to have a stabilizing effect. But you know, I think up until someone does numerical calculation in time, it's hard to tell what it is because there are different contributions. So if you do this in a Schwarzschild spacetime as a stabilizing effect, if you do it in Kerr as a destabilizing effect, so I think the situation is not very clear.
Also, Charles Gammy was showing some films. I don't know if you saw them.
I wasn't here.
Also at Caltech, but he was doing it in Kerr, but I think without the reaction effects, he wasn't calculating the mass and angular momentum flux. So it was, I think, the accretion was just brought about by some viscosity or something in the fluid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you haven't seen this.
I haven't seen that, no. But I think he probably is interested in different regimes of densities here.
Like,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't remember the
details. So, I mean, Jim Martin was asking this question and you said, I guess you agree with him.
Mm-hmm.
But is it then significantly harder to do what he says computationally? Or?
No. In fact, these guys have done it. I mean, again, in axisymmetry, they have done it and they have found, and we are now also doing these calculations, as I was saying. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So.
So the equation statement used for these disks was n equals 4/3.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions: if the stuff is really a nuclear density, I would have thought that a higher evap index, like 2, would have been better.
Yeah. But
second question is: how sensitive is this mechanism to changing the equation statement?
Okay, so I'll answer the second question, which also answer the first. The answer is doesn't change much. I mean, if you change the equation of state, we'll have different sizes, and usually, you will have different computational needs. Usually, if you have a very big torus, it has a larger inertia, you need a larger grid to cover it accurately. But the dynamics doesn't change by changing the equation of state. And we even tried by, you know, you can, with a polytrope, you can use the polytropic constants to get different sizes and different densities and.
So
we didn't find
it. Coefficient in front.
And a gamma as well.
Gamma also.
Yeah.
So why are you using gamma equals 4/3?
Well,
skipper equation state.
Okay, so the reason why we've done that is because we are catching up with Fontaine on this. Okay, so the first calculation they've done on this was with gamma equal 4/3, where they were having no oscillation. So basically just have a torus which is already outside of this, let it go into the black hole and see the instability. We wanted to study something which was a bit more realistic, but then we also needed to compare with them. Yeah.
So, I'd like to ask
comments about the astrophysical scenario here. I mean, if you look at some of the Japanese simulations of neutron star merger, I don't think there's much evidence of a torus being left behind in the merger. So,
I wouldn't agree with you. I mean,
in fact, the strongest thing would probably be a gravitational radiation radiator, which is a bar structure that's formed.
That's if you create a neutron star at the center. I think Mazar was shown, I think even on the web here, that if you have neutron stars, now I can't remember which, probably with a stiff equational state, and are in equal masses, then you are likely to produce a torus. The amount of, I mean, what would come out like a torus? At the time he stopped his simulations, you really have these spiral arms, which are produced. But you would expect that in a couple of orbits, that will give you something looking like a torus. And the amount of mass he was calculating outside the apparent horizon there was 5%, and with a very high angular momentum. So probably that matter was sticking around for some time. So I think there is evidence from Mazar's calculation that it is the case. And in Newtonian theory, these guys have found this a long time ago, mid-80s. Ruffert was, you know, talking about these objects. So I'm not going to bet my check on this, but I think they are likely to be formed. And if you talk to an astrophysicist, they would say, of course, there's going to be something like that.
The other question that I wanted to ask is the statement about the strength of the radiation being larger than that from the supernova calculations. So again, trying to do this in my head, if you have a supernova, some forms of mass motion are this large convective motion inside of the proton neutron star. And that's a good fraction of solar mass moving around quite rapidly inside the neutron star.
Yeah, but that's really not giving you the bulk of the signal. Bulk of the signal is when you have, you know, the almost homologous contraction. That's when you have, and you have then the shock back. That's when you have the peak in the gravitational wave signal, and then you have the small oscillation, which are produced by, you know, convection, internal motion, maybe instabilities. But so the largest peak, if I remember this right, you have a waveform which goes like this, and then, you know, has a peak, and this is when basically you have the shock and the bouncing, and then the thing settles down and oscillates. So it's this guy here we are comparing with.
What sets the non-spherical structure that gives you? So it's perfectly spherical.
But these are rotating
so
simulations. Effectively, what they find is that you end up with something which looks like a torus. I mean, it's not like in this picture because, you know, you still have basically a new proton-neutron star, but a proton-neutron star has a condensed core and then has a ring of matter which is orbiting, and then you have an envelope which is lower density. I mean, that's, if you wish, that's the only way in which something which is collapsing is going to go. Something will have just enough or too much angular momentum to fall at the center, and so we'll have to hang around up until it loses it. Thank you.